The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
It's 5:30 on Monday, and it's time for the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center Radio News, your source for community news on your community radio station, WEFT 90.1 FM. I'm Kimberly Cronick, your host for this week. In this week's IMC Radio News, reporter Ondine Gross talks to Carol Wagner, author of Soul Survivors, Stories of Women and Children in Cambodia. Carol Wagner coordinates the nonprofit organization Friendship with Cambodia.
Carol Wagner is from Eugene, Oregon. She has visited Cambodia 5 times. Her first trip was in 1991, and her most recent trip was this last March. Carol leads study tours to Cambodia for global exchange. She was a UN observer in Cambodia's 1998 election. In 2002, her book, Soul Survivors, Stories of Women and Children in Cambodia, was published. Last fall, she started Friendship with Cambodia, a nonprofit organization that is raising funds for scholarships for girls, small loans for women, and vocational training for landmine survivors. Welcome, Carol Wagner.
Thank you.
Carol, can you give us an overview of the U.S. role in Cambodia, beginning with the bombing during the Vietnam War?
Yes, I think that most people, when they think about Cambodia, they remember the Vietnam War and the bombing. But what a lot of people don't know is the extent of the bombing. And we bombed Cambodia for 4 years, and we dropped more bombs than all the bombs dropped in World War II. So it had an extremely devastating effect on the country, throwing the whole country into chaos. The U.S., because Cambodia was trying to be a neutral country during the Vietnam War, it wasn't supporting the U.S. And so the U.S. Overthrew the king, helped overthrow the king. And afterwards, the general that was installed was very corrupt and didn't have support, and anyway, he eventually left. That's when the Khmer Rouge took over. So all this chaos and destabilization led to the genocide, and that began in 75 and continued for 4 years till 79. And during this period, most of the world didn't know what was going on in Cambodia. It was really isolated. And it was because during the genocide, I should just mention a little about that, the Khmer Rouge was a communist movement but they were very extreme, and they had the idea of creating a classless society where everyone was equal. And in order to do that, they proceeded brutally to put everybody in labor camps, work camps, where many people died from starvation and disease and overwork. And then they also started executing the educated people. So during this 4-year period, a quarter of the population died or was killed, and that would have been 1.7 million people. And the Khmer Rouge also wanted to expand Cambodia into its former empire, into Vietnam and Thailand. And so it was the border dispute with Vietnam that actually brought an end to the genocide, because the Vietnamese, tired of that war on their border, invaded. And getting back to U.S. policy, so then the following decade, the 1980s, Cambodia was supported by Vietnam. And because the U.S. still considered Vietnam the enemy, because of our Cold War policy, and of course, Soviet Union was supporting Vietnam, Vietnam was supporting Cambodia, then Cambodia just automatically became an enemy of the U.S. And so during that 10-year period, the U.S. supported a civil war in Cambodia, where the Khmer Rouge and other resistance groups started fighting the Cambodian government, which was supported by Vietnam. The U.S. policy during this period was also to bring down the Cambodian government, and in order to do this, they blocked all humanitarian aid to Cambodia through the United Nations. It was the only time ever that humanitarian aid has been blocked. It also appointed Khmer Rouge leader as the UN representative in Cambodia. And U.S. policy then completely changed when the Soviet Union collapsed, and the Soviet Union pulled their support from Vietnam. Vietnam pulled their support from Cambodia. And in the 1990s, Cambodia entered an era which we might call an emerging democracy. And the U.S. supported the election. We, through the United Nations, there was an election in Cambodia. And they've continued along this path of having, you know, a sort of a democratic society. I say sort of because it's very corrupt, but anyway, in the U.S., instead of supporting the Khmer Rouge, decided that the Khmer Rouge should be brought to trial for crimes against humanity, and so they, we, as the U.S. Government, started funding the gathering of evidence for an international tribunal, and this tribunal hasn't taken place yet because the United Nations is still negotiating with Cambodia to set this up, but anyway, that's a little background on U.S. policy in Cambodia. And today we're supporting Cambodia and its development. It's one of the poorest countries in the world, and the U.S. is giving some aid to Cambodia.
You've written a book about the women and children of Cambodia. And what got you interested in this, and what led you to write that book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really didn't have that in mind. I actually went in 1991 on a peace walk in Vietnam, and afterwards some of us went to Cambodia, and I was really taken aback by the level of poverty. I had visited developing countries before, but never had I seen the extreme level of poverty there, and also how shell-shocked people were. You know, the genocide had just happened 12 years earlier, and people were still in a state of, you know, post-traumatic shock, I guess. And I started, you know, talking with the people and hearing their stories and, you know, what they had been through. And it was just, you know, it's beyond belief what they've been through. And yet what they were saying was, you know, what I was hearing was how they were rebuilding their lives and helping each other. And I met an orphan boy whose father was an architect and had been killed because he was educated. And this boy who was 12 years old, you know, managed to survive the 4 years of genocide and ended up fleeing, you know, through the jungle following other people that were leaving the country. And he ended up here as a refugee and had a difficult time here as well, but finally worked his way through college. And after graduating college, he went back to help rebuild his country. Mm-hmm. And I was just so touched by that. I was amazed that someone who had suffered so much would, you know, go back and help. And his, I just found that his story wasn't unique, that there were other people, you know, most people had equally tragic stories and were helping each other and, you know, rebuilding their families and their country in different ways. So I think it was the fact that those stories really illustrate the strength of the human spirit, and they inspire us. I think they help put our lives in perspective, because, you know, how can I complain about the problems in my life, you know, when I see what they've been through? It gives me a lot of encouragement to, you know that I'm going to get through whatever problems I'm going through. And another reason is I really wanted to share the perspective of women and children. I think when we hear accounts of history, it's so often from, you know, the perspective, a military perspective or a political perspective, it's the voices of the men. And I feel like, you know, let's hear a little more from the women and children. And ultimately, I hope the book will be a tool for peace, that we can, you know, as U.S. citizens, see the impact of our policies, you know, the long-term impact on people's lives, and also see, you know, factors that lead to genocide, you know, injustices in the society and the difference between the rich and the poor, the big gap there. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to learn from it and work for peace.
Well, speaking about genocide, you've developed a curriculum for teachers to use that come with your book. And you've done a lot of thinking about genocide and developed this lesson plan. Tell us about what you've learned.
Right. Yeah, I have to say that in the research I was doing for the curriculum to go with my book, I found some really good material from on a website called genocidewatch.org, and it's based on the work of Gregory Stanton. And I think that, you know, genocide is something that's, you know, it hasn't happened once, it's happened many times. And Gregory Stanton's work is such that it shows us how we get to genocide. You know, what are the stages that lead to something this horrific? And what's amazing is that, you know, the first few stages are happening around us right now. And, you know, it starts with classifying people and creating categories and, you know, creating an us and them, whether it's based on ethnicity or race or religion or nationality. And then it moves on to the next stage of symbolization, where we start naming people, you know, and using derogatory names for certain groups. And also the distinguishing them, you know, by the way they dress and or look or something. And the thing that's important to remember is that at each stage of these stages of genocide, it can be stopped, and each of us can play a role in stopping, you know, it at that stage. The next level is called dehumanization, where one group denies the humanity of another group, and of course that makes it easy to kill someone when, you know, you label them as evil. And the next level is organization, and this is usually done through the state, you know, through the government, although sometimes it might be a terrorist group. But of course in Cambodia it was the Khmer Rouge, you know, the Pol Pot government. And when we get to these higher stages, you know, we have to have more intervention from, you know, governments and the United Nations. And the next stage, polarization, is where the groups are sort of driving each other apart, and or, you know, they're starting to intimidate one group. Like, for example, the Khmer Rouge started by intimidating the teachers and driving them away. And the next stage is preparation. And in the case of Cambodia, it was putting people in work camps and identifying those people who they wanted to kill. The next level is extermination, where they actually begin the mass killings. And then the last stage, interesting, is denial. And when you talk to all the former Khmer Rouge leaders, they all deny that they had done anything wrong. Pol Pot said, you know, I have a clear conscience. And so this again is where, you know, the international tribunal needs to come in, that, you know, the evidence is heard and a court, you know, that the whole thing goes before a court. So I think it's really important that we keep an awareness of these stages, and you know, as individuals and a nation, not move anybody in those directions.
Well, my mind is just spinning, thinking of so many places around the globe right now where these very things are happening.
Right. Right.
And, you know, one of the end results is a country just riddled with landmines. Are landmines still a problem in Cambodia right now?
Yeah. Cambodia is one of the most disabled countries in the world. There's a huge number of landmines still in the ground, 4 to 6 million landmines. And I mean, basically, Cambodia has had 30 years of violence. And the landmines are really difficult to find. They don't have metal in them, so you have to probe. The deminer lies on his or her stomach on the earth and probes the, you know, soil inch by inch with a knife to try and find the landmines. So you can imagine how tedious that is and time-consuming. So it ends up costing like $1,000 per mine to remove a mine. So it's going to take another 100 years or more to remove all the mines in Cambodia. And every day, another two people on the average are stepping on landmines. So it's really a immoral weapon.
What a tragedy. Gosh. Let's talk about the women in Cambodia today. What is their situation like?
Yeah, I wrote quite a bit about, or, you know, included the stories of women because I really wanted them to talk about their situation. And I think, you know, Cambodia, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the poorest countries in the nation. So it's the poverty that is really affecting everything in the country. One is education. Only half the women in Cambodia are literate, so only half the girls have an opportunity to go to school. And most of them have to drop out between third grade and fifth grade because they're needed at home to help their parents just to survive, you know, to work caring for younger brothers and sisters, or, you know, selling fruit, or working in some way. And the girls that end up in high school, I think only 14% of the girls that start school end up at the high school level, and when you get to the college level, about 10% of the students are girls. So one of the reasons I started this Friendship with Cambodia organization is to provide scholarships for girls to help them with their education. And so, you know, so many aspects of their lives improve once they have education. But there's definitely other problems. One of the problems now in Cambodia is because of the garment industry. Well, in 1998, Pol Pot died, and that was the end, finally, of all these years of violence. And at that point, a lot of foreign investment came into Cambodia because it was finally at peace. And the main industry that came in was the garment industry. So now 1 out of 10 young women is working in a sweatshop. And the conditions are, you know, very bad. They have to work long hours under bad conditions. You know, they can't get time off even when they're sick. You know, they have to pay if they miss any time. And, you know, they can't get up to go to the bathroom. I mean, it's really harsh conditions. And that's another problem that women are facing. I think one of the ways that women are really helped in Cambodia is to offer them credit where they can borrow, you know, $20, $30, $50 and start some kind of small business. And, you know, I've seen so many women, you know, their lives be turned around with just this small amount of money. And they might, you know, start raising chickens and selling chickens, or maybe, you know, start a beauty shop, or maybe raise flowers to sell in the market. Lots of different ways that they can then bring in some income in to their family. And once they have a little income, you know, the nutrition for their family improves. I mean, 45% of the children in Cambodia are malnourished. So, you know, nutrition is important. You know, they could buy a bicycle so their, you know, daughter could go to school. They can, you know, get medicine when someone's sick. They can repair their house when it's needed. So their whole quality of life is really greatly improved with that small amount of money. And, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, what's $30 to us? You know, I mean, it's, you know,
a couple of movie tickets and a pizza.
Really? And it makes such a huge difference in changing people's lives. So.
And so does your organization help connect money to these women so they can make these purchases?
Right, exactly. That's, yeah, Friendship with Cambodia it's a volunteer organization, both administered by volunteers here in the U.S. and then also by volunteers in Cambodia. And we channel the money to organizations that were started by Cambodian women and are helping each other. So that's one aspect of Friendship with Cambodia. And we focus on three main areas. One is the scholarship program, one is the small loans for women, and the third is vocational training for landmine victims so that they can find a means of employment as well.
Wow, that sounds really useful. And you've talked about, you know, your five trips to Cambodia. Well, in the introduction, we talked about you've been to Cambodia five times. But what inspired you to start this organization? I'm always sort of interested in what the transition is in people from sort of private citizen slash onlooker to somebody who really wants to roll up their sleeves and make a difference. And so what was the source of your inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, I've been sort of witnessing Cambodia's poverty and struggles now for over 10 years. And I don't know, it's taken me that long to sort of decide to start an organization because it's sort of a big deal to try and, you know, manage an organization. But I think it was really sort of the despair I felt last fall about our current government. And I lived overseas for a year and a half, and I really saw, you know, sort of a European perspective of the U.S. And, I mean, most of the European nations really see the U.S. as a world bully. And when you visit the third world countries, you see an awful lot of the problems that those countries are dealing with, you know, came out of U.S. policy. And I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes that policy is well-meaning, but the end impact is pretty devastating. And so I feel, I don't know, it was my reaction to the what I see, a lot of violence in the world, a lot of greed and domination right now. And I just want to do what I can to bring in the opposite qualities of, you know, kindness and understanding and cooperation. And I think it all starts with, you know, us as individuals doing what we can on a small level, a small scale, but still that makes a difference. And, you know, I started this organization in Eugene, Oregon, and, you know, I have about 25 volunteers, and most of them have never been to Cambodia, but, you know, they want to do something helpful and kind for other people that are, you know, less fortunate. And I think that that's what my wish and vision is to, you know, bring this kindness forth.
And if people wanted to help support this organization, how could they reach you or reach this nonprofit?
Right. Yeah, we don't have a website yet, but I have a website for my book, and that website is CambodianSurvivors.org. And my email for the organization is CambodiaEDU@hotmail.com.
So once again, the title of the book is Soul Survivors, Stories of Women and Children in Cambodia by Carol Wagner. Carol, I just want to end with you telling us a little bit about the Cambodian people. And what did you learn just by being with them than even comparing them with Americans or other places you visited?
Right. You know, one of the things that touched me the most on this last visit, I just came back in March, was when I visited some of these women's organizations and in the rural areas. And in Cambodia, most people are rural, and it's very poor. And one thing that they're trying to do is not rely on foreign aid, instead try to find a way to improve their lives with their own means. And so one thing they're doing is starting these self-help groups. And so there might be like 20 or 30 women in a group, and they will start a savings program where they each put in like a dollar a week, and that might be, you know, one day's income wages. And then every 2 weeks they have a drawing, and one woman gets all of that money. And that's a significant amount of money. It's like, you know, for us it would be like 2 months' wages. And so you'd be talking thousands of dollars on our scale. Their average annual income is just $280 a year, so it's very low. But anyway, so the women, when they talked about, and they could use that money for, you know, buying fishing equipment to improve their income, or you know, buying something to help their family. And when we went around the circle and people told how they spent the money, about half of them gave the money to someone who they thought was more poor than they were and in more need. And I mean, it completely blew me away, because I thought, you know, where in the U.S. could you find that, you know, for someone to give you, you know, $8,000, and for you to turn around and give all of it away to someone who you thought needed it more. I mean, And that, I think, is so illustrative of what I've seen in Cambodia, which is it's a very different mentality where you feel like you want to help other people and that you're willing to put your needs aside to help someone else. And I think, you know, it's made me realize what a me-first society we live in, and including myself. You know, I just feel like, you know, I'm going to think about my own needs first, and then, you know, then I'll help somebody else. But there, they're just a lot more generous, and I did keep running into, you know, other examples of that.
Well, I really want to thank you for coming today and teaching us so much about Cambodia and how we can assist. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
For IMC Radio News, this is Undine Gross.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. We would like to give a shout-out to our friends in Macomb, Illinois, listening to this on 106.3 WTND. If you'd like to get involved with the show, drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org. That's radio@ucimc.org. Or call 344-8820. 344-8820. No experience is necessary. Archives of this program are available at the IMC website, ucimc.org. That's ucimc.org.
Whole heart, my rooms was backed up by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. Sent out to purify the Khmer race by creating a classless society. They rose to power, taking over rule of Providence, recruiting soldiers, poor illiterate peasants. By the time Pol Pot took over Phnom Penh, his military has reached over 30,000. They emptied out cities, bombed banks, cleared out prisons, separate family, eliminate private property, and outlaw religion. No warning shot was poets never twice.
Was total chaos.
They destroyed all aspects of social and culture life. Soldiers demanded that all family packed up small supplies of food and clothes. They were told,
don't you worry, you'll be back in due time now. Leave your home and march out of town in a single file line.
Let me remind you, the U.S. United States is gonna bomb Phnom Penh's heart. But it was a lie, it was more like a dying death march. It's about power, territory, and rights. And of course that come with a hefty price. Whenever there's war, there's always sacrifice. And it's usually the innocents who lose their lives. It's about power, territory, and rights. And of course that come with a hefty price. Whenever there's war, there's always sacrifice. And it's usually the innocents who lose their lives. They target all intellectuals, survivors, prisoners. Often ditch their eyeglasses, you try to pass as taxi drivers. No one was told who was running the country, but only those in power was called Angka. Children was brainwashed into believing in them. They was taught that there's no such thing as parents at camps. Most execution occurred at night. Soldiers awoke the prisoners suspected of any crime and quietly lead them into the field of forest. Ordered them to dig their own grave. Those who marched for death, either they stabbed, beaten, buried alive to save bullets. This ain't no bullshit. In the next 4 years, the horror of the killing field rise, with almost everyone in the country forced to grow rice. It's a tragedy based on part of a mistaken idea. It seems they thought that the ancient reservoir was a giant rice growing machine. It's about power, territory, and rights. And of course that come with a hefty price. Whenever there's war, there's always sacrifice. And it's usually the innocents who lose their lives. It's about power, territory, and rights. And of course that come with a hefty price. Whenever there's war, there's always sacrifice. And it's usually the innocents who lose their lives. It's about power.